Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Donald Trump isn't the first political maverick elected to the White House. Teddy Roosevelt, who became president in his early 40s when President McKinley was assassinated, was a disruptor who learned how to use celebrity to his advantage. Richard Nixon was a disruptor, too, beyond the illegal activities of Watergate. So how do we view Donald Trump in a historical context? Two presidential historians weigh in. And I'd like you to think about this question with the caveat that it is early days yet in the Trump term. What do you think history will say about this moment in American politics? Are there other presidents that you think Trump can be compared to? So what does history say about where we are? And yes, I stipulate that we are just about 30 days into this. Are there other presidents that you think Donald Trump can be compared to, and maybe you have a good argument for that? Here's the phone number, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter, at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Elizabeth Cobbs is with us. She's a historian and professor at Texas A&M. She's working on a novel about Woodrow Wilson's embrace of women's suffrage, and she joins us today from College Station, Texas. Elizabeth, is the novel isn't out yet, is it?
No, actually, got our wires slightly confused there. I have just published, it's coming out from Harvard Press, a nonfiction book about America's first women soldiers and how they helped to change Woodrow Wilson's mind. I'm also a novelist.
Okay, all right, good to know.
That just came out on Alexander Hamilton, so I'm in all parts of American history.
Thank you for the details on that. Good to have you on the show. Tim Welch is with us. He's a historian and former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library, and he's with us from Iowa City. And Tim, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Kerri. Good to be with you.
Tim, political mavericks who end up as president are pretty few and far between, it seems. Why is that?
Well, in a way, the goal of every successful, not every successful candidate, but most successful candidates is to, you know, come bring people together, you know, come together and follow me. It's a kind of a call to people to join and kind of celebrate the nation, but then to move forward. I mean, much the way FDR did in the great crisis of the Depression. And so successful presidents, or Father Abraham following Lincoln, as we did to bind the nation together, and most of his speeches would speak to that. So the blueprint for a successful presidency, as far as historians might say, would be to smooth over and to conciliate. The disruptor, of course, is the person who draws upon the anger and the angst of a certain percentage of the people and the outrage, and can stimulate a lot of attention. In some cases, it can stimulate positive change. The populist movement of the late 19th century, although it didn't lead to any great candidates, it did shift the nation's political matrix and be more accommodating to the concerns of farmers and to workers. So disruptors can be valuable, but in the short term, disruption causes a lot of angst, as we heard from Ken Rudin, and we're hearing from lots of people, because we're just not certain where disruption is going. And it's, in some ways, it's a combination not only of the general disruption, but the kind of on-the-fly uncertainty of what type of disruption.
So, Elizabeth, this is, you heard Ken really kind of wringing his hands about the methods that Donald Trump uses and some of the techniques, and I think his lack of interest in what Tim Walz just said about really being a conciliator. I mean, he doesn't seem to really care if he is viewed as a uniter or a divider. You were going to say.
Yeah, I think sometimes he seems to be a person who mostly wants attention. So it's a problem. A disruptor can be a profoundly creative force, but they have to have a program. In the case of Donald Trump, it's really a sort of flailing against the system in a sort of a look at me kind of way. So although not to say that some of the issues he's raised aren't important ones, for example, Defense Secretary Mattis has followed through on Trump's issue about the supposed free riding of Europeans in NATO, you know, not paying their share. Absolutely have not paid their share for many years. So there are glimmers of reasonable issues, but then they all get mixed together. So like, you know, Trump is also saying we want the spoils of war, in which case then he starts to sound like Mussolini, not like any president in all of American history. So that's the precedent busting kind of thing that Trump is doing. We have very few real precedents to draw on.
You know, Elizabeth, you've kind of reminded me that often presidents are students of presidential history. Do you get the sense that Donald Trump is really interested in that and that he would be aware of some of the comparisons that you've just made?
I don't think so. I mean, we look at someone like Andrew Jackson, of course, to whom he's been compared, because Jackson was such a rabble-rouser and so belligerent and pugilistic and all of that. But Andrew Jackson was, in a way, deeply schooled. He was somebody who had elective office. He was somebody who'd been in the military for years. He was, you know, of course, butt up against the origins of the whole republic in the 1820s. So, you know, he was a student in a sense of history, making history. Trump really doesn't seem to have any interest at all or any knowledge. He compares himself just in that clip you just gave us to Jefferson and Jackson and Lincoln, and you know, I don't A, see the comparison, and B, think he has any real sense of what the relationship of those men was to the press.
Yeah, Tim, since Elizabeth brought up Andrew Jackson, I thought I would read something that historian James Kloppenberg of Harvard wrote about Trump and Andrew Jackson. He says this in Politico: Jackson was unlike his predecessors in nearly as many ways as is Donald Trump. He was unapologetic, white supremacist, a narcissist inclined toward authoritarianism and violence, and a defender of the code of male honor, perpetually outraged by those who disrespected him or his wives. When elites dismissed Jackson contemptuously as unqualified to hold office, he proclaimed himself a man of the people, and many white American men embraced him. Does sound like that, like there are some threads there that link the two. Do you see that?
We do look for similarities between Jackson and Trump. And in fact, I think when we compare presidents generally, we're looking for indications, and it sort of calms the nerves. That is, if we see the rough edges of Andrew Jackson in Donald Trump, it helps us think, well, maybe President Trump will work out okay, that we would like to emphasize the positives. I think with Jackson, too, one of the problems we have, and it's the kind of the presentism. We know that the Jackson story turns out fine. But we are uncertain as to the direction we're going with President Trump. There's no question that there are those similarities. They both appeal to white males. They both see themselves as outsiders. They both are petulant and have tempers. But the story at this point, we really can't prognosticate. We can't go forward and try to say, oh, yes, well, now we have another Andrew Jackson. So it's the difficulty that history has in trying to predict the future that is the challenge.
So if you've just tuned in, two presidential historians with us this morning, Elizabeth Cobbs from Texas A&M and Tim Walch. He's the former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library, and asking them about the track record of political mavericks, what we understand about presidential disruptors. And yes, with the caveat, it is early days yet, but what we're starting to see, if there are any commonalities between some of these previous presidential mavericks and the way Donald Trump is behaving and governing as president. And here's something I'd like you to think about. What do you think history will say about this moment in American politics? Think about that. I'm hearing from you on Twitter. You can also call in by phone, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR, where Juliet says, it took a reality star for people involved to get involved in politics again After years of letting corporate America take over government, people finally got mad. Tim, do you interpret some of what happened here in the last election and where we are with, do you think Juliet has a point there?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think there's no question that Donald Trump's message resonates with a sizable percentage of the American people. Maybe as many as a third of the voting populace find his message and what he said at his press conference, as much as it makes Ken Rudin put his head in his hands, there are many people who found the press conference stimulating and that they agree with what he has to say, even in the case of giving misinformation or erroneous information. That does not bother them because they like the tone and the excitement, the anger. It responds to their sense of outrage. And so that's what keeps his popularity. And I think that's why he was at Melbourne, Florida over the weekend. And I think we can expect we're going to see rallies. This is a president who enjoys the rally. He enjoys stimulating the people and the people stimulate him. And then he generalizes from those rallies. He sees that as a microcosm of the entire nation.
Exactly.
Now, that's not true.
Right.
But, you know, in a way, that's what makes it difficult to say, now, which president is he like? Well, there is no other president who did what he is doing. And, of course, this is the first president where social media has been so important. So with Twitter and Facebook and so many other forms of social media, we are in unprecedented territory, which has given everybody a start, so to speak.
Yeah, Elizabeth, I was going to say beware the rallies, right? Because they can be, I'm sure, very heady, but they don't necessarily tell you much. It's a self-selected group. It's probably your core enthusiasts, and they may not tell you very much about where the rest of America is on you.
Well, also the other problem, you know, history can be comforting, but history can also be chastening. So Andrew Jackson didn't turn out very well for the majority of lower class Americans. You know, by killing the Bank of the United States, Andrew Jackson sent the economy into a tizzy. And for the Native Americans, of course, it was a complete disaster. So we look back and sometimes we think of this as all this kind of smooth progression, you know, that history is. But as the Chinese curse goes, may you live in interesting times. I actually spent the weekend in Beaufort, South Carolina, because I'm doing research on the Civil War for another book. Mm-hmm. And I was just reminded of how complacent the Southerners were that this was all going to turn out. And their rabble-rousers, as they were called, the fire eaters in places like Beaufort and Charleston, South Carolina, you know, rallied people with pretty disastrous results for the American Republic. I always remember, don't forget, the British eliminated slavery with a tax on soap.
Wow.
They had a retail tax, and they voted down slavery, and they put a tax, and they reimbursed the slave owners, and, you know, life chugged on, not perfectly, but without a disastrous war that killed, you know, 750,000 people and upset the entire economy of the South. So history, it's very important. It tells us to keep calm and carry on. We have weathered worse things before, but it's a reminder that when a person incites violence, as the president has did in his previous rallies, or refuses to abide, you know, by law, or refuses to reveal his own tax returns and yet rails about corruption, that even though, yes, there is a substantial minority that approves, that's not necessarily, you know, a comforting thing.
Patrick says, in answer to my question about what history will say about this moment, fragmentary surviving records indicate a very advanced civilization brought down by authoritarian hubris. PhD dissertation 2825. And to the phones here, to Gretchen in St. Paul. Hey, Gretchen, hi.
Hi. I guess I just wanted to point out to the historian's comment about Andrew Jackson's president turning out just fine. Andrew Jackson authored the genocide of an entire group of people, his Indian Removal Act. So I wouldn't call that turning out just fine for a whole group of people.
Gretchen, I'm sorry, go ahead. I was going to say, I thought Elizabeth, you just denoted that, right?
Well, yes, but I think that Dr. Welch was sort of saying, you know, when we look back on Jackson, it seems like, you know, we survived. But as I was pointing out, yeah, some did and some did not, just as you point out quite correctly, Gretchen.
And Tim, you would add?
I guess I'm the defender of Andrew Jackson. I suppose what I'd have to say is, and this speaks to Elizabeth's point and the caller as well, and that is that we do tend to smooth over the rough edges. And they're absolutely right about Jackson and genocide, and there were many controversial elements to his presidency. But among historians, when you see presidential rankings, and I understand there's a new one out just recently, Jackson tends to get rated quite high generally among our presidents as a president who asserted executive authority. So you hate to say on balance, because that dismisses some of the horrible things that he did to the Cherokees and others. But in truth, we tend to give him a fair amount of credit for his presidency.
Gretchen, did you want to add something to that?
I guess I would just say that, you know, we're talking about a lot of white male historians, and we can't really understand the rough edges. To me, I guess it depends on who's talking about it. You know, the rough edges of the Soviet Union could be called the Gulag. Are those rough edges? I don't know. I think we really need to have a new conversation about what it means to turn out just fine and for whom.
Okay. Elizabeth, maybe you'd want to respond to that.
Yeah, well, I was so excited and delighted that the Treasury Department decided to kick Andrew Jackson off the $20 bill, yeah. Hip, hip, hooray, and substitute Harriet Tubman, about whom my next book, the book I'm working on, is concerned. So, you know, I think that probably most of us historians look at the Republic and we're just glad that that the United States has managed to maintain its institutions despite a lot of travail over so many generations. And it's those institutions that have allowed us to go back and reexamine our history. So, you know, I think that they come through. But I'm in complete agreement with Gretchen on Andrew Jackson. And as a presidential historian, I'm not one of those who would rate him very high.
Stephen Duluth says, I think Trump uses the classic tools of propaganda. If you repeat a lie enough times, people will eventually believe it. And to the phones to Jackie in Minneapolis. Hey, Jackie, a question for our guests.
I have a question. It is, have we had in the past rabble-rousing presidents who come from an arbitrary win-all-business perspective? It seems that rabble-rousing, business-oriented acumen is not the same as a rabble-rousing, democracy-oriented acumen.
Okay, so the business background, Elizabeth, maybe you'd weigh in on that too. Who have we had in previous presidents who have had the kind of intricate business dealings that Donald Trump does?
You know, we don't have any real precedents. He is the only person who's come into office without any government service whatsoever, either military or legislative or as a cabinet member or anything else. So it's this bizarre thing. I mean, he's a person who's saying, you know, we're going to stand up for the one, you know, for the 99%, and yet he's the 1%. And so it's this bizarre combination of things. I mean, I truly think he's fairly unprecedented. However, that said, I think we have to be careful not to just focus on Trump. And I'm with Tim on this. It's also really important to look at the Americans to whom this appeals. And now some of those are folks who are, you know, approve of the bigotry or racism that and sexism, of course, that Trump clearly espouses. But I also think that there are people who just sort of don't have a strong sense that either of our parties have done a good job articulating clear agendas for the future. So rather than simply focusing on Trump, I think we really need to think about how both Republicans and Democrats can do better, because this is a man who had a hostile takeover of his own party.
Right.
And also the Democrats were unable to mount a successful enough campaign to beat him.
You know, Tim, this is interesting because Thursday night I do this Indivisible program. It's this national call-in, and we talked about elites and the way Donald Trump uses that term as an expletive, basically. Yet it cannot be ignored. And this is how we started the discussion Thursday night. He is a billionaire who lives and works in a golden tower. I mean, he is absolutely the definition of elite, and yet he's been able to mount this populist movement. It's so dissonant logically, and yet it works.
Absolutely. And I mean, in effect, his style and manner of presenting himself is quite populistic. I mean, the swagger, the boasting, the commentary is very different than the polish and sophistication you'd expect of elites. And this appeals to people almost in the manner of an evangelical preacher or somebody who comes out and says, you too can have what I have if you follow me. And people really respond to what Trump has to say in that manner. So that has been his primary form of success, is his ability to convince people that what he says is right, even though the facts don't support what he has to say.
Tim Walsh is one of our guests this morning. He is a historian and former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library. And Elizabeth Cobbs is with us. She's a professor at Texas A&M University, a historian and a novelist. And they're giving us some perspective, some insight on this question of where, yes, we're caveat of, you know, just 30 days in here, a little over a month into the Trump presidency, but we're seeing the way it appears he's going to govern. We're seeing how he ran his campaign. And we're asking our guests and you about how that fits in with what we already know about presidential history, especially when it comes to disruptors or mavericks who have been elected to the White House. And then I'm asking you this morning what you think historians will say about this moment in American political history. 651-227-6000-800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Tim, here's an interesting question from somebody on Twitter who says, is there a precedent for a president who communicated in such a deliberately muddy manner? I think that question about the communication style is a good one.
Sure. And of course, we would ask our presidents to be clear and forthright in what they have to say. But it's also true that presidents enjoy obfuscating if they can. And most people will recall the early press conferences of Dwight Eisenhower, where he would go out and mangle syntax in his responses to questions. And there are those who say he said he was going to do this deliberately. And in fact, people would show a certain amount of deference in response to his answers and go away scratching their heads. So sometimes presidents will obscure what it is they really want to say, and they do it deliberately. And people often point to Eisenhower as an example.
Can I ask you, Elizabeth, since you're researching a new book about the Civil War, where does Abraham Lincoln fit in here? And I ask that for this reason. He was elected with a great geographical split, and the map, I mean, it didn't look exactly the same, but when you see the division that we saw in this electoral map, this is something that he might have understood. So where does he fit in when we talk about the polarization of Trump?
Yeah, well, certainly one of the things that historians often emphasize when they talk about how the Civil War came about and how Lincoln got elected is the breakdown of the party system. That the party system, the, you know, civil dialogue back and forth between the parties, previously the Whigs and the Democrats, that kind of exploded. And then that led to an electoral cycle in which, you know, it was completely divided and Lincoln got no votes, you know, south of Mason-Dixon. So, and of course, that led to our greatest disaster in all of American history, which was the Civil War. But one of the big differences is that there really was a single issue that was dividing the American public. Everybody knew what that issue was, as much as people like to say, it's states' rights. It was states' rights to do a particular thing, which was to hold some people as slaves. So we don't have that kind of divisive issue. People are upset with each other and annoyed each other and cranky with each other and, you know, feel ripped off and that the system is corrupt and rigged. But there's no clear issue. And so I think that that is a very big difference. I don't think we have quite the same worry. I don't have the same worry as a historian that our country's going to split in two.
You know, that's a really interesting point. I mean, even though probably levels of distrust of government and many others of our institutions might be at unprecedented highs, you're right. There's not one specific thing where public opinion is so divided. Does that make it even more unusual, Elizabeth, that we are divided the way we are?
Yeah, I think it is. Although, you know, I also think it's if we look at what's been happening over the last 15, 20 years, we've had a long series of wars. Wars are very destabilizing. They're morally destabilizing in a way. I mean, they make people wonder, what's the purpose of the country? Who are we? What are we doing? You know, they create economic dislocation. So there's a combination of factors, a perfect storm, if you will, that has really led, I think, to this phenomenon of somebody who's completely outside. Now, by the way, Jimmy Carter, remember, you might recall, mm-hmm. you know, also touted himself as an outsider, you know, one of the first deep Southerners to be elected the president in many decades, aside from, you know, Johnson, which is a little bit of a different scenario. So there are oftentimes people portray themselves as outsiders, but Trump is an outsider who doesn't have respect for the system and doesn't have much respect for American values. So that's what's really odd about this. So I don't know. I don't think of him as a phenomenon where he represents all of what America's about. He's somebody who the wheels of democracy have kicked up, as they do sometimes. Very strange individuals in a very disturbed time.
Tim, I hear a lot of political journalists describing this populist kind of movement. Although I would submit, and I'm interested in your view on this, that he is an unusual standard bearer for the kind of populist movement that we're seeing now. Now, do you see a populist movement here, or is it something different?
No, there is a populist movement, and I do think it is rooted to some extent in that feeling that white males who worked in manufacturing and other heavy industries, where they had a nice salary, often had a summer home and a boat and so forth, and found over the past 40 years or so that their salaries have been stagnant or they've lost their jobs and couldn't find any replacement, and they're angry. And Trump responds and appeals to that sense of anger. And so there's a sense of desperation within that populism, because the world economy is such now that we're all interlinked, and there isn't an easy solution to their anger and to their problems. So the challenge of running was one thing, and campaigning, which is what he's still doing, because he's already launched his campaign for 2020. but governing is completely different, because executive orders are like commands from a king. I mean, it's a piece of paper with his signature on it. That's different from legislation. And I think that's where the Congress is, and a Republican Congress, is increasingly uneasy, because they see a president who doesn't seem to be responsive to not only the division of power, but also the need to carefully develop a legislative program and to fund it and to go forward with it. So,
Tim, you've hit on something that I wanted to bring up with Ken Rudin, and we ran out of time. I get the sense that, given the fact that he's already back on the campaign trail, and I know that's the great kind of warm and cuddly stuff that presidents like to do, because they like to see people idolizing them, right, to get back out on the campaign trail. But he doesn't seem to be all that interested in the day-to-day grind of governing. And maybe he's not all that unusual in other presidents. I mean, how many of them are truly policy wonks the way Barack Obama was?
You have to go, I mean... too much of any one thing is a problem. So if you're too much of a wonk and enjoy reading policy papers and endless debates and discussions before going forward, it tends to slow government down. On the other, and you want some bold leadership and intuitive leadership. On the other hand, with Donald Trump, they say he doesn't read memos that have more than about 3 or 4 bullet points on them, that he doesn't read background papers unless it's about him or his administration. So and his staff and aides find it difficult to make a point with him in the office, and they find the way to get across to him is to go on television and talk to him through their TV set.
Crazy.
So, I mean, this is, as Elizabeth suggested, and I think Gretchen as well, there's a lot of unprecedented qualities that Donald Trump has that his staff is trying to work around at this point.
Yeah, Elizabeth, do you have the sense that his staff, these people kind of signed on for these jobs, maybe not fully aware of what this was going to be like to try to influence his thinking? Because his circle seems really, really small, and the way they have to influence him seems really unusual.
You know, it's hard to see in the heads of those folks. I mean, and some of them are really good people. Jim Mattis happens to be a fellow at Hoover Institution, where I'm affiliated as well, and so I know that he's a real patriot. And so I assume that this is somebody who signed up for this deal because he felt that, you know, America needs good people at a moment like this, especially. But, you know, I think part of the problem here is that, you know, Trump appeals to people who don't understand what government really does for them. And so the fact that he's going to take up the government or mess up the government or not know how to run, actually run an administration, that sort of doesn't bother them because they don't understand what government's for. It's sort of like, you know, down with government. So there's a real anarchistic aspect of Trump's administration, which is in some ways the most disturbing.
Elizabeth, I wish you well with the upcoming book on the Civil War and Harriet Tubman. Boy, that sounds interesting. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Cobbs with us from Texas A&M. And Tim, thank you. Always a pleasure to have your insight and your experience in the discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.